From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for August the 27th, 2017. Yes, the last Sunday of August, as summer slowly slips away. Welcome to our weekly look at the politics and policies that shape our lives as we go from City Hall to the State House and all the way out to Washington, D.C. So, yep, time to grab the Sunday paper, go get that cup of coffee. We'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. And a welcome back to Dave Schwann after your Southern Illinois road trip to bring us back all the news of the solar eclipse.
And what a road trip it was. Thank you, Rick.
Well, how's your eyesight?
Oh, it's fine. It's fine. And, you know, I have not heard one story about people saying that they have had problems now with their vision as a result of looking up at the eclipse. I haven't heard one story, so apparently everybody was paying attention when we were really trying to get the word out. You must wear those glasses, in order to watch the eclipse, wherever you may have been.
Well, of course, we saw that the president took a brief glance.
Yeah, and someone said, Mr. President, you really should wear these. Oh, okay.
Actually, there were people yelling, don't look, don't look. What can I say? Well, did you go to any interesting places while you were down there?
Where do you want me to start?
Well, they're all interesting when you get that far south in Illinois.
Yeah, we did go to some interesting places. First of all, we stopped at some classic Route 66 institutions, one of them being the Ariston Cafe in Litchfield, Illinois, south of Springfield.
Route 4?
Yep. It may be the oldest continuously operating restaurant on the road, anywhere from Chicago to L.A., as they say. Still run by the family that opened it back in the late 20s or early 30s. Adam is the last name. Nick Adam and his wife Demi, the perfect hosts. And hello to them. They were, as usual, very gracious and cordial. Stop at, we did our check-in on Dean's show in Odell, Illinois.
Yes, yes, yes.
At a marvelously restored Standard Oil gas station. It was perfect. The timing was right. We pulled off. Sam, if you remember, we were standing outside a soybean field when we did the report last week. And I will probably end up telling Dean this story as well. When we wrapped that report up, a woman pulled into the driveway, the area there outside the gas station, got out of her car, came over to me, and she said, "Are you Schwanny?"
Really?
She was listening.
Wow.
In her car.
I told you
report.
You were famous down south. You didn't believe me.
So, a wonderful, wonderful person. We struck up a conversation, Marilyn Carr. So, a shout out and a hello and thank you for listening to Marilyn Carr, if you are listening this morning. Thank you so much. One other place, Rick, I know we talked about this as well.
Yes.
Got to mention it. We were doing really some family history research. My mother's side of the family is from Southern Illinois. My grandfather was born on a farm in the very small town of New Minden, Illinois. New Minden is, I guess, about an hour outside of Edwardsville, the Metro East area there. But there is a place that's known to the locals down there called the Blue Room in New Minden. Has to be seen to be believed.
It sounds like it, yes.
We'll be posting more. We've got a bunch of stuff up on my Facebook page now on the trip. Route 66, the eclipse in general. We'll be posting more things. So if you want to check it out, go right ahead.
Well, I know you had to spend the night all the way over in Edwardsville.
Right.
Several hours from Carbondale because of all of the people that,
flocked
to the area.
That was the closest place we could find.
And,
yes.
And Domiti Pongo, who was in for you last Sunday, he and I both went to SIU Edwardsville. So
we drove right by the campus.
Well, and of course, the question that we were asking in your absence was whether you were going to pet the cougar.
Oh.
Which was not code for anything. I had to remind everybody, but that's how the show started last week, was whether Dave's going to pet the cougar.
The answer is no.
Did you take a drive through the campus?
No, we didn't. We didn't. To be honest,
you had enough driving.
Not only that, we got a little turned around.
Oh, really?
Driving.
You got lost in Edwardsville?
Yeah, well, not outside of Edwardsville. But we made up for it because we did a little nostalgic route with my father, who lived in Wood River, Illinois, and Alton, Illinois, where my mother is from. So we kind of drove around a little bit and meandered back toward Edwardsville and eventually finally finding our room. But no, I didn't pet the cougar.
So, and
I don't even know what that means.
Well, the cougar is the mascot of Edwardsville. The Saluki is the mascot.
The Saluki is the Carbondale. Yeah.
Yes, but
of which there is a great big Saluki statue there as you walk down the steps from the arena where they play basketball and walk over to the adjacent football stadium.
And as we were talking before the show, that football stadium is much bigger now than it used to be.
That's what Roger Badish was saying. Yeah, yeah. But, easy to get around. May I also say that they had everything very well in hand there. They didn't have a problem. Everybody was just there to have fun, enjoy the day, enjoy the phenomenon of nature. And it was just a marvelous experience. And SIU campus down there in Carbondale is beautiful.
Yeah, it is very, very beautiful. But you also got a taste of the Southern Illinois climate, which...
Classic Southern Illinois summer weather.
Uh-huh. So it was, how hot was it down there?
It was well into the 90s. Probably humidity to match.
Yeah.
I was just a sponge.
Yeah.
By 2 o'clock in the afternoon with all the running around we did.
Well,
all of it worth it, though. It was a marvelous experience.
How dark did it get?
It didn't get dark, like night, but it was a dusk-like feeling, almost, that moment between, the last minutes of sunset, a dusk before the sun is going to be gone completely. But the thing that blew everyone away was how quickly that happened.
Mm-hmm.
We were expecting, a gradual decrease, a diminishing light like you experience during a sunset. No, at about 1:19 or so, just before the true moment of totality, it just got dark very quickly.
Just like flipping a switch.
Almost like flipping a switch, yes. The other thing that was, I can't quite describe the shade of light that we saw when the moon started to move away and the sun began to emerge. It is the weirdest shade of a greenish light I have ever seen.
Hmm.
It was just very, very weird. I tried to describe it, and I couldn't. Just one of those things where you had to experience it.
Wow. Well, another one for your great history book.
Yeah. It was and we'll be back. We'll go down there. I don't know where I'll be in 7 years, but do have to venture down to Southern Illinois again. And, of course, stopped at 17th Street Barbecue.
Yes, thank you so much. And picked up a little goodie bag of some sauce for me, and I appreciate that very much because I didn't get a chance to see them out at the State Fair when I was down there because it started raining, and I thought
they were jammed in there.
Well, in Murfreesboro,
Wow. Yeah, just packed in.
Well, and they actually had someone from the Adler Planetarium was there at the restaurant during the eclipse between 11 and 3 o'clock to offer guidance to the folks while they were eating the ribs and the brisket and all of that good stuff. So they know how to do it down there.
They sure do. No, they did it. Everybody, all of those communities just did an excellent job of handling traffic. I mean, there's only so much you could do when you have close to 100,000 people there. But as I say, I do not know of any serious incidents that took place.
Yeah, well, Carbondale, folks, well done.
Well done, right.
Absolutely. And a big night in sports last night, which I couldn't stay up for.
It started at, 10:50. I thought you'd be up for it.
Boxing really isn't my thing.
Did you watch it, Sam?
I watched it. Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Watched all 10 rounds. Watched McGregor have spaghetti legs in the ninth. He just started falling into the ropes, and then you knew. I mean, Mayweather started off pretty slow like he usually does. He was just testing McGregor out, and then by the seventh or eighth round, he started to pounce, and then a tenth round knockout. But Conor McGregor, who was cashing welfare checks 5 years ago, will make over $100 million after all is said and done on this fight.
Mayweather made twice that, though, didn't
he? Mayweather could make about $300 million.
Yeah. Wow.
With the pay-per-view buys, the ticket sales, the merchandising, and the gambling, this could be about $700
million. A $700 million payday.
No, a $700 million fight, which is the richest fight in the history of the medium.
Yeah. I'm just...
You just didn't care, did you?
Boxing, no. It's just, I don't know what, but it's never been something I really cared about.
It was a spectacle, and this was something we had never seen before. The best boxer pound for pound, and Mayweather, who's now 50-0, a tremendous record, and the UFC champion, Conor McGregor. He put up a good fight. It was more entertaining than I thought it would be, but at the end of the day, you knew Mayweather would come out and take care of business, and he did, and he said afterwards it would be his final fight.
Well, and I know there was curiosity about McGregor as a UFC, a mixed martial arts expert, you know, what kind of a boxer would he be? And, I mean, some of the things I saw on social media was that they were very surprised that, you know, he did put up and won probably a couple of those early rounds, as you say. But it ain't my thing. I'm more curious about this whole deal with ESPN changing announcers at the University of Virginia game.
They didn't want Robert Lee to come back into Charlottesville.
Yeah, I mean, and Robert Lee is an Asian American, but I don't know. That just is so very strange, and I don't know that anybody would care. I mean, yeah, sir, we know about what happened in Charlottesville, obviously, and we're still talking about what happened there with the deadly protest. But I don't know. I just think that's a bit overreach.
The issue is he got his assignment weeks before Charlottesville.
Right.
So he knew where he was going. I think ESPN just in general, and they'll tell you differently, the last thing they wanted was for him to open up the broadcast and say, live in Charlottesville, Robert Lee reporting for ESPN. They did not want that to happen. And they've taken the precautionary measures to avoid that. He's been reassigned. They say it so he could be closer to home, but we know why they reassigned
him. Of course. I don't know. I understand, but I think, as I said, I just think that's a bit of an overreach, if you ask me.
I agree.
Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Sam's here with the latest sports. Producer Jasmine's here to field your phone calls. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. It's also our text number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is here to feed me my cold medicine since I still can't get rid of the only thing I brought back from the state fair. Remember, as always, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on a sunny North Michigan Avenue. Of course, all our thoughts are with the people in Texas with the now tropical storm still wreaking havoc as far as rain and flooding. Just before I came in this morning, KHOU-TV in Houston, their studio began flooding. And so the TV station is moving up floors to try and still stay on the air. And in effect, a warning put out by law enforcement authorities there that if the water is rising, if you go to the attic, make sure you've got tools to be able to cut your way to get to the roof. That's how serious things are down in Houston. So, again, our thoughts and prayers are with everybody down there. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics. And, of course, as this storm, which was a Category 4 hurricane, bore down on Corpus Christi, Texas, 135-mile-an-hour winds, torrential rains, everyone's concerned with that. President Trump decided upon a series of actions. First, he gets rid of Seb Gorka, who had fascist underpinnings in Hungary, had trouble getting security clearances, and served as Donald Trump's counterterrorism advisor. The thing is, nobody actually knew what he did for the White House except to go on TV and defend the president. Then the president issued a directive on transgender troops, advising the Pentagon that no new incoming members of the military could be transgender. He did leave some room, apparently, for Defense Secretary Mattis to decide how to deal with those transgendered troops already in the military. And then, of course, he pardons Joe Arpaio, the former Maricopa County, Arizona sheriff. Arpaio was facing sentencing for disregarding a federal court order to stop profiling Latinos. Trump called him a good man. The record, however, leaves that open to a very serious question. His service resulted in tens of millions of dollars in court settlements paid for by the taxpayers of Maricopa County for failing to follow the law. That also included a midnight arrest of the owners of an independent newspaper that had been writing stories raising questions about his service as sheriff. The arrest was based on a grand jury, they said, but the grand jury never met. Just that incident alone cost the taxpayers of Maricopa County $3.5 million. But here's what Arizona's largest newspaper had to say about Trump's action. Quote, "This erases any doubt about whether Trump meant to empower immigration hardliners and nationalists after the violence in Charlottesville. Arpaio is their darling. Arpaio is now back on his pedestal, thanks to the president. Donald Trump's pardon elevates Arpaio once again to the pantheon of those who see institutional racism as something that made America great. By pardoning Arpaio, Trump made it clear that institutional racism is not just okay with him, it is a goal." That's from the Arizona Republic. Now, not only do you have that, but there's also the concern that this pardon could serve as a precursor for other pardons, like anyone that Special Counsel Robert Mueller investigates for misdeeds into relation to Donald Trump's election as president. Now, Trump signaled this pardon last week at a campaign rally in Phoenix, where the president spoke for nearly 80 minutes, devoting about a half hour to attacking the media. And for the most part, he blamed his own problems on reporters.
It's time to expose the crooked media deceptions and to challenge the media for their role in fomenting divisions. And yes, by the way, they are trying to take away our history and our heritage. You see that. And I say it, and you know, we're all pros. We're all, like, we have a certain sense. We're smart people. These are truly dishonest people. And not all of them. Not all of them. You have some very good reporters. You have some very fair journalists. But for the most part, honestly, these are really, really dishonest people. And they're bad people. And I really think they don't like our country. I really believe that. And I don't believe they're going to change, and that's why I do this. If they would change, I would never say it. The only people giving a platform to these hate groups is the media itself and the fake news.
I was stunned when I heard it the first time. I was stunned when I heard it just now. We actually try to write history. We're not trying to take away history. We try to write about history and our culture and try to help inform people. That's at least what most of us try to do in this business. So understandably, it's always easy to pick on the media. The president spent a half hour doing it. And later in the show, we'll kind of maybe explain using his own words why the media is important. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on your Sunday Spin, excuse me, Sunday Spin. Oh, this is good cold medicine I got this morning, Dave. We've got Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, Democrat from Schaumburg. We'll talk about the political climate in Washington, particularly after Donald Trump's latest actions on Friday.
Now The Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. I played that cut about the president talking about the media, and one of the problems that the president said he had with the media was that he felt mistreated by them over his statements following that deadly protest involving white supremacists in Charlottesville, Virginia. For example, this is how he explained things to the audience in Phoenix.
Here's what I said on Saturday. We're closely following the terrible events unfolding in Charlottesville, Virginia. This is me speaking. We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence. That's me speaking on Saturday, right after the event.
Actually, he said that, but there were a few more words to it, and he left those words out. And, you know, to refresh everybody's memory, here is Trump speaking directly after the Charlottesville protest.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides.
That's right. On many sides. On many sides. Repeated for emphasis. Those words didn't make it into his Phoenix speech. He also didn't include in his Phoenix indictment of the media the fact that he also said there were some very fine people marching with the white supremacists. So, there you go. That's part of our history now. Well, joining me now on the phone is Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy. He is the United States Representative from Schaumburg in the Northwest and Western Suburban Illinois 8th District. Congressman, thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, good morning, Rick. How are you?
I'm still suffering from a cold, unfortunately, from the state fair, and there's nothing lingers longer than a summer cold. But it's a good thing you're probably on the phone, so that way I can't give it to you. I wanted to talk to you about, first of all, as we've been talking about this morning, the actions of the president on Friday as everybody was kind of watching Hurricane Harvey hit the Texas coast. But one of these things is the issue of pardoning former Sheriff Joe Arpaio. And a lot of people having the question of, is this send a symbol, particularly in light of Robert Mueller's investigation?
It does. You know, first of all, I think that I hope that we keep the people of Texas in our thoughts and prayers as they confront Hurricane Harvey, which I believe resulted in one fatality already. But with regard to Sheriff Arpaio, just to give your listeners a little bit of background, he unconstitutionally racially profiled people. In other words, he detained people based on the way they look, whether they looked like Mexicans or Latinos, and detained and arrested them. And he did so even after being instructed by a court, a federal court, not to do so. And when he continued, he was held in criminal contempt. And over the weekend, we learned a couple things. One is that the president apparently tried to interfere in the DOJ's prosecution of Sheriff Arpaio, which is a big problem. It continues a disturbing pattern of the president basically interfering in law enforcement's investigation of ongoing crimes or criminal activities of folks in his administration, and in this case, of the sheriff. And then secondly, he issued a pardon outside of the pardon process completely. There's no consultation with DOJ. And also, the sheriff showed no remorse for what he did. And so, you know, I believe that this all the more highlights the need for increased transparency in the pardon process, especially in light of the Russia probe. I've introduced something called the Presidential Pardon Transparency Act, which basically corrects for a huge loophole that exists in the pardon process now, which is that the president can actually issue pardons in secret. And so we don't know if he's already done so to his colleagues or associates or family members in connection with the Russia investigation. I've called for public disclosure of any pardons that have been issued because any secret pardons could impede the ongoing investigation of that particular probe.
Well, and in many respects, too, there's the question of the preemptive pardon, which is
right.
Kind of what
right.
Arpaio got because he had not been sentenced yet. I believe he was facing up to 6 months in federal confinement. But, you know, we, as you mentioned, there's the reports out now that he consulted with Attorney General Jeff Sessions, asking if the Justice Department had to continue its prosecution of Arpaio. Sounds familiar, kind of the same kind of issues that were raised with FBI Director, then FBI Director Comey, with Sessions himself about Mike Flynn.
Right, exactly. It's the same fact pattern. I will say this, that the president's actually bringing people together in condemning him. You know, many Republicans, I'm heartened to say, came out against what he did on Friday night with regard to the pardon process. I'm specifically thinking of Speaker Ryan, John McCain, and Jeff Flake, and others. And so I'm hoping that we can approach this in a bipartisan way. We can bring some reforms to the pardon process and make sure that going forward, the president can't just exercise his pardon power willy-nilly without any checks on his power.
You know, you mentioned about Speaker Ryan, certainly Senator McCain raising issues here. But, you know, every time there is a controversial act by this very unconventional president, the question becomes, at what point do, and obviously you're a Democrat, but at what point do the Republicans start stepping away from this president?
I don't know, Rick. The one thing that I'll say is that the president appears to retain some strong support among Republicans, although I think that it's starting to erode. I think that among independents, his standing has gone down. But, you know, here's the thing, Rick, which I really hope everybody urges their representatives to do, which is regardless of which side holds the presidency or occupies the White House, I think that we in Congress have to exercise our oversight power and do the right thing. And that's why I am glad that, for instance, after Charlottesville, and I'm glad you played that news clip where, you know, the president clearly tried to equate the actions of those who were preaching hate with those who were opposing the hate preachers. Again, numerous voices on the other side came out in condemnation on the Republican side as well. But now, you know, we have to follow up those words with actions and do the right thing in Congress.
And, you know, I know that there were concerns about the Department of Justice under this administration and grant money flowing. We're going to talk a little later about the state legislation involving immigration and law enforcement in the state of Illinois, a bill that Governor Rauner is expected to sign tomorrow. But you have some of these questions about, you know, grant monies from the federal government being withdrawn for things like because of immigration or because of concerns about, you know, hate crimes.
Exactly. Danny Davis, Congressman Danny Davis, and I wrote a letter last week to the Department of Homeland Security and others, essentially questioning why grants that were issued to groups that receive funding to combat white supremacism had that funding cut off only 1 month after a report came out from the FBI saying that white supremacism was on the rise. This was, in particular, there's one group called Life After Hate that's based here in Chicago in Congressman Davis's district that was doing tremendous good work on this particular issue in combating anti-Semitism, the rise of hate, the rise of prejudice. And why would we ever try to stem their activities? I'm concerned about this, and I think that now more than ever we need to do whatever we can to, you know, basically counter the hate preachers, the neo-Nazis, the Klansmen, and others who, you know, basically are, you know, perpetrating what we see are hate crimes and indeed what's happened in Charlottesville.
What actually do you think are some of these factors that are leading to that the rise, the kind of a renewal of the white supremacist movement? Is it the
I
economy?
Don't know all
is
the factors. I don't know all the factors conclusively, Rick. That's why I've in part called for a bipartisan, independent national commission to study the rise in bigotry and prejudice and extremism and hate crimes, and figure out solutions to it. But I do suspect that here are a couple factors. One, I do think that the rhetoric, starting with, tweets at the top to people who are affiliated with the alt-right movement, essentially are fanning the flames of prejudice. And I think that that emboldens people who may have held feelings of bigotry or hatred or prejudice to now act upon them. And that is very disturbing. It's touching people across the spectrum and in an adverse way, obviously. And I'm hearing from it every day from my constituents, Rick. It's, you know, whether it's Jewish groups who are basically telling me that they're getting an increase in calls threatening violence. These are to, like, schools, elementary schools, Jewish elementary schools, JCC schools, to mosques that are telling me about vandalism and also the need to increase security, to Latino and Hindu and Sikh and for that matter, LGBTQ groups. So it's really across the board, and, you know, we have to put a stop to it, Rick. There's no place for hatred in America.
I just have to wonder if social media isn't a contributor in this as well.
I think so. And, you know, there is this, unfortunately, you know, on the social media, in social media circles, there's unfortunately some, the president accuses folks on the other side of the aisle for perpetrating fake news or accuses the press of propagating fake news. But we are seeing in social media all kinds of, theories being propagated that are clearly fake and that are meant to inflame tensions and relations between different people.
It's interesting times that we're living in. We're speaking with Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, Democrat from Schaumburg. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue in downtown Chicago. And joining me on the phone is Democratic Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy. And Congressman, we had a texter actually with a question, and I think I know the answer to this. Is they were basically asking, going back to the pardoning issue, whether accepting a pardon isn't that somewhat of an admission of guilt. And it's my understanding for civil purposes that it is considered an admission of guilt if in civil lawsuit cases. So just that's my understanding of the situation.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you, since we're talking about, you know, social media, hate crime, this kind of thing, I know also that you've been looking at this issue of freedom of speech and the kind of the issue on college campuses where, and you know, being a First Amendment advocate and a free speech advocate, it somewhat troubles me, despite some of my own views on some of these speakers, the fact that we're not using campuses to avail ourselves to all learn from even people we vehemently disagree with.
Yeah, I in principle, I agree with that, Rick. We actually had a hearing recently in the Oversight Committee to talk about this issue. And, essentially what I believe is that, both, people, for instance, let's take the issue of the alt-right. There have been speakers from the alt-right who visited campuses. And, I think that especially in a private setting, private university campus setting, if they're invited and they are given a place to speak, I think that people should be given a place to peacefully protest against them as well. In a state campus setting, I think that the protections for that type of speech are even greater, because obviously you have a state actor, you have a government actor, and now the First Amendment really does squarely get addressed. At the end of the day, Rick, I think that in our country, we have to protect freedom of speech jealously, just like we protect the freedom of the press jealously, because that's how we hold government to account. That's how we make sure that, different minority groups are protected and that our country flourishes, and you know, what are considered to be radical ideas aren't squelched just because the people in power disagree with them. And I believe strongly in that.
Well, and I guess that's why, you know, when we looked at President Trump's address in Phoenix, and he vilifies the press for half an hour and then says, I'm a strong protector of the Second Amendment. And it's like, there is a First Amendment, too. And but I just wonder, though, we just seem so polarized and divided these days that, you know, that's what actually people forget about what our rights are all about. And
exactly. I think that you hit the nail on the head. I think that the president is here to, he has to protect all the, parts of the Constitution that exist, regardless of whether he agrees or disagrees with them. I think that he's obviously a strong proponent of the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms. But the First Amendment is rich in protections that ensure that government is held accountable. And I'm concerned about the erosion of these rights. If somebody engages in speech that would amount to a hate crime, that incites violence, so that basically targets people based on what they look like or their sexual orientation or threatens them in any way, that's a different story. That goes from speech to something.
That takes it a step further.
That takes it a step further. But on the other hand, if they're, engaging in, more, philosophical speech or speech that isn't inciting people to violence, I think you have to allow for that. It reminds me of that Skokie protest. You may remember.
Sure.
When the Ku Klux Klan, I believe, or neo-Nazis or both came to Skokie. And they were virulently anti-Semitic. And as you know, Skokie has a large concentration of Jewish Americans. What I really admired is that, basically the authorities in Skokie, a gentleman delivered the notice to the Klansmen or neo-Nazis to be able to protest or to march, I should say, in the village of Skokie, and then he went over to the other side and started protesting his speech in a peaceful fashion. I think that is the ultimate, picture of what free speech in this country looks like.
I want to ask you quickly here about goings-on in D.C.
Yes, sir.
We now have the president announcing in Phoenix that as part of trying to make sure that the debt limit's extended, that we have budget, that he's willing to shut down the federal government unless Democrats also support the U.S. paying for a border wall.
Yeah, I'm not going to support building a border wall. I think that, the president should present a clean bill, so to speak, on raising the debt ceiling. And we need a spending plan, by the way, as well. We have to do this in a bipartisan way, Rick. What often happens in Washington, D.C. is that certain folks will not vote for any federal spending under any circumstances. And some of them are members of the Freedom Caucus. And so what ends up happening is that the speaker relies on Democratic votes to raise the debt ceiling and to come up with a spending plan, a rational spending plan. And so, if that is going to be the case, and I suspect it is, then it needs to be a clean bill. It can't have these crazy conditions on it, such as building a border wall. Can I just mention one other thing that's
Sure.
a piece of positive news in Washington. I'm pleased to say that I passed my first major piece of legislation in Washington that had to do with career, technical, and vocational education. It's affectionately known as the Thompson Krishnamurthy bill. It's the longest title bill in Congress. essentially attacks the skills gap in this country. There's 6 million unfilled positions in the workforce, and it's mainly because employers can't locate the skills among folks to fill those positions. So what this bill does is it equips our young people and people in career transition with a credential, a certification, or a skill set after high school to be able to get a job. And it basically means that even though, a four-year college or university degree may not be for everyone, an education must be for everyone. And I'm pleased to say it passed not only with bipartisan support, but unanimously through the House. That never happened.
I was just going to say, yes.
Never. And so it's a glimmer of hope for what can happen when good people on both sides focus on substantive issues and try to move working families forward. And so I'm just so pleased with that. We have the hard work of getting it through the Senate, and then obviously we need President Trump to sign it. But in my humble opinion, it can really change our economic trajectory as a country for the better, and significantly if we can get this bill passed. It has support, like I said, all across the spectrum, management and labor. It has support from obviously Democrats, Republicans, and in our city, Sox and Cubs fans.
Well, we will be we'll be watching the progress of this in the United States Senate. Raja Krishnamurthy,
absolutely.
Congressman from Schaumburg, Democrat, 8th District. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Hey, thanks, Rick. Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with David McSweeney, state representative, a Republican from Barrington Hills. We'll be talking about what's been going on as far as the school funding issue, as well as changes in Governor Rauner's administration.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Now, it's been an interesting few weeks for Governor Rauner. He shook up his staff after an embarrassing political defeat on the budget and taxes in July, replaced them with leadership from an ideologically driven libertarian conservative group. And then last week, he dumped some of the hires he had made on his press staff after an embarrassing statement about a cartoon that the group put out that many lawmakers considered to be racist. And then on Friday, after Republicans said that they and Republican leaders said that they and the governor had a tentative deal on school funding, the governor went downstate to Marion, and he complained about the bill.
We've got a new funding formula. We've been battling it through. It's also got more school choice in it, and it's a funding formula that I believe in. It's a better system. Bad news is Speaker Madigan's caucus took the bill, inserted a bunch of bad things in it. We're trying to get out as many of those as we can. They're trying to divert a lot of the money that should be coming to Southern Illinois and Central Illinois and divert it to the broken financial condition of Chicago. So we've been battling that, and it's not been easy.
So there's the governor saying he's still working to remove the Chicago funding from the bill, even though it's part of a deal. But when an audience member asked him about the tentative deal, Rauner said this.
There are many other good reforms in there. The bad news is, again, there was an insertion to assist Chicago in its financial crisis and diverting money that shouldn't go to Chicago. It should go in the classroom spread around the state. Some could be in Chicago, but much of it should be here, Williamson County. It should be in Sangamon County as well. It's not fair, but it's going to end up being a compromise. It's not where we'd like it to be, and what I'll try to do is fix the problems with it in subsequent legislation.
So that's where that stands, at least if the uncertainty that exists there, as we have the four legislative leaders are to meet in Springfield this afternoon with a action scheduled by the Illinois House tomorrow when they convene at 11 o'clock in the morning. And to talk a little bit more about this subject. We have on the phone Dave McSweeney. He's the state representative, Republican from Barrington Hills. Representative McSweeney, thank you for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Rick. I'm excited to see Trubisky today. I think he's the real deal.
I wonder at what point they actually start him.
Hopefully soon. I'm a Ditka guy. Ditka loves him. That's good enough for me.
Fair enough. So we have this agreement in principle, as it's being described, or a near deal on the issue of school funding. Of course, what really set this into motion is in enacting the budget, state aid dollars are predicated on the adoption of a new school funding formula. And that's where the problems existed. Democrats passed a version of a bill to distribute state funding to schools throughout the state. The governor used his mandatory veto powers to rewrite that legislation. There aren't enough votes in the House to override the bill. The Senate has, but as of now, there aren't enough votes to override it in the House. And so we've had these negotiations. And so we're presented with a plan which, based on what I'm hearing, looks very much like the Democratic original version of the bill, especially how it deals with Chicago public schools. And then as a sweetener, if you will, a provision creating a $75 million kind of private school scholarship fund. It would allow people to get a tax credit on their state income taxes for donating to this fund that would turn around and help reduce tuition costs for students attending private schools. I don't know, given some of the feedback, given some of the rhetoric and some of the pushback, I don't know that the votes exist for that plan. I don't know what you're hearing.
I think the deal's in trouble, and I think the reason the deal's in trouble is because it is a big expansion of spending. We just had a tax hike, and we're losing people in this state. That tax hike raising the income tax rate by 32% was a disaster. And we're here today talking about this because of the budget and tax increase that passed. The money has been appropriated. The solution is just simply to drop this requirement for a new funding formula and release the money to the schools. This funding formula is going to cost $7.5 billion over the next 10 years. Where do we get the money? We have $14 billion of unpaid bills. We cannot raise taxes. In fact, we need to repeal this tax increase, which is killing jobs, driving people out of the state. It is clearly a Chicago bailout. In fact, Mayor Emanuel had a big smile on his face on Thursday night and was crowing there actually is more money in this bill, and the rumor is $7 million more than was in SB1. You know what the incredible thing is? The financial analysis hasn't been released yet. They want to vote on it tomorrow, and they're only going to release the financial analysis tomorrow. Diane Rotto, your reporter of the Tribune, has actually done the best work of anyone. We have great staff talking about the long-term implications of the $7.5 billion in this plan. It does nothing to reduce property taxes. It does nothing to cut school administrative costs. It does nothing to encourage consolidation. It is just business as usual. I favor the scholarship grant tax credit, but there is so much bad in this deal. It is so bad for the state of Illinois, and we cannot raise taxes again. We need education reform, but we need to work on that over time and make sure we could actually pay for it and that we're cutting spending to pay for it.
How many other Republicans share your view on this?
Well, I think a lot. I've been talking to people over the last few days. I have a lot of respect for Jim Durkin. He does a good job as our leader. He's been working it hard. He was dealt a tough hand. I mean, this has been a done deal. The Democrats passed an appropriations bill with the help of some Republicans who supported the tax increase, and they're saying now they want to spend $7.5 billion over the next 10 years. The budget was booby-trapped, but I think this is a bad deal and that we should just simply release the money to schools immediately based on the existing education formula and just eliminate the requirement to adopt a new model. This is a bad deal.
What about those? And I mean, it's well known that the funding of Illinois schools, it's perhaps the most inequitable funding formula in the country.
And what we need to do is we need to get it right, Rick. And spending $7.5 billion over 10 years without any real reforms, we need to make sure the money is spent in the classroom. There's no requirement in this bill that administrative costs at schools, the big salaries, the bureaucracies at a lot of school districts, that those have to be cut. There's no requirement of consolidation that be studied. There's absolutely no requirement for property tax cuts. And all the rhetoric from the governor about TIFs and the negative impact that they have, what did we end up with? There's a TIF commission, no reform in TIFs. So we need to go back to the drawing board, spend time adopting a real education formula reform bill. But for the time being, just eliminate the requirement. The money's for a new formula. The money's been appropriated. Release it, and let's move on.
Well, and that's why I'm kind of curious about, you know, this near deal, as it were, because many of the things that the governor complained about as part of this is his contention of a Chicago bailout are still part of the deal.
I'm confused by the governor's position, frankly. I mean, he's railed against the Chicago bailout for a long time, and I want to make sure Chicago school kids are well-educated, taken care of. Chicago is a very important part of this city. I'm not anti-Chicago. I'm pro Illinois, and I represent the 52nd District, the Northwest Suburbs, but I also represent the entire state. But the governor has spent months railing against this thing. Mayor Emanuel shows up on Thursday night with a big smile on his face, which I understand, crowing that he's getting, the rumor is, $7 million more for Chicago. Then you just played the tape of the governor railing against Chicago again. And let me be clear, there are not going to be any changes in the bill from what was negotiated on Thursday. So I'm very confused about where the governor stands.
Yeah, and particularly the TIF, or tax increment financing issue, because, and quite frankly, I know he feels that the city of Chicago has abused that, and there are over 145 tax increment financing districts in the city, and not to go too far in the weeds, but those districts are created, and growth in property taxes do not go to the taxing bodies like schools. They go into, basically they're supposed to be plowed back into the district to further the development of the district. But schools lose out on the money. Governor's complaint was, well, that's not fair to school districts that don't have any TIF districts, and that taxpayers are subsidizing schools that have TIF districts. That's his contention there. But the fact is, there are TIF districts throughout the state of Illinois, and TIF districts aren't created by the school districts. In fact, most school districts hate TIF districts. They're created by municipalities, and in some cases, municipalities actually will contribute some money to the school districts to get these. But in the end, it's still going to be the system that would provide more state dollars to make up for the loss in those TIF districts.
Well, you look at the situation right now, and I think there needs to be reform in TIFs. I don't think we need to go as far as the governor did in his AV, in his mandatory veto. But let me just be clear. This bill has no TIF reform. This bill has a commission. That's the last thing we need in Springfield, Rick, is another commission to study things. We need action. I mean, the people of the state are leaving because of high property taxes. They're leaving because of this recent tax increase. So what we need to do is just eliminate this booby trap, this requirement that Speaker Madigan put in to a bill that, again, some Republicans supported that gave us this large tax increase, and just release the money. And we could move on. I mean, Andy Menar has done great work. Bob Pritchard on our side. A lot of people have done work. This is not ready, and we need property tax relief with it. We need to cut administrative costs. We need consolidation. None of those things are in this bill. So that's why I think it's a total disaster.
We're speaking with Republican State Representative David McSweeney from Barrington Hills. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. I'm speaking with Republican State Representative David McSweeney from Barrington Hills. Representative, I had played that cut of the governor speaking in Marion about the school legislation. And here again, it seemed to be a bit confusing what he was saying. And this has been kind of a pattern going on for the last couple of weeks when he shook up his staff after the legislature overrode his veto of the budget and the tax hike. he shakes up his staff. He says the problem he felt was that his message wasn't getting out. And yet, for the last several weeks, there seems to be a problem with the messaging. And, you know, the issue of the Illinois Policy Institute, which is where he went to recruit many of the people that are now at the top of his administration. The Policy Institute puts out a cartoon that some lawmakers say they thought was racist, doesn't really take a stand on it. But I guess what's going on in the second floor of the state capitol with the governor?
What? I think the governor needs to take responsibility. I'm a Reagan guy, and Reagan always had a clear message. He didn't need to worry about hiring messengers. Whether you agreed or disagreed with him, you knew where he stood. And I think the problem starts at the top. The governor needs to recognize that he needs to communicate a clear message. The CPS tape that you played is just an absolute clear example of that. And also a tax increase. The governor talked for 2 years vaguely about supporting a tax increase with some kind of undefined reforms that were constantly changing. And we need to make sure that we're very clear as a party telling people where we stand. So I don't think the issue is staff. I think that the issue is the governor needs to be clear about what he believes in. I think Christina Rasmussen is a capable person in the governor's office, but the responsibility starts with the governor. I watched the Fox national TV interview, and I came out of that interview with more questions than answers and exactly where he stands. So I want the governor to succeed, but it starts at the top. And as far as the staff changes are concerned, the governor certainly has the right to make any changes that he wants. The one I still have a question about, frankly, is the general counsel to the governor, Dennis Marasco. Wednesday, the original story was that he was out. Thursday, the governor said he was in. Thursday afternoon, he had resigned. Friday, he was escorted out of the building, according to some reports. And that's a very important, a very sensitive position. So that's one answer I think the governor needs to provide as soon as possible, is what exactly is the situation with Marasco, and what are the details behind his departure?
Yeah, because, it, as you said, and the governor had a very rare staff phone conference call with staff and said that any talk of Marasco's departure was just rumors. And then by Thursday afternoon, Marasco is staying on till the end of the month, and then he's leaving. And then, as you said, the reports on Friday that he was escorted out of the Thompson Center after the governor gave a very effusive praise to Marasco in his statement Thursday. Something just doesn't seem to add up there.
It doesn't, and the governor can clear it up right now. He should just issue a statement to him and come out himself and just explain exactly what's going on. Are there any issues with Marasco? Were there any issues in that office? Are there any investigations? Are there any other issues going on at this point? I think the governor should be very, very clear about that situation. He has the right to pick his staff. I think Christina Rasmussen, again, is a good chief of staff, but I would like answers to this Marasco situation.
Well, going back to the messaging issue, and I guess I'm wondering, and you pointed out the Bret Baier interview with Fox News, and actually I thought he was very clear in that. 10 times he said something was broken. But I mean, as we look ahead to the 2018 elections, and it's not just the governor's race, but it's also, you know, the General Assembly, the Illinois House is up. There's probably 40-some seats in the Senate that are up. And the strategy, of course, of Republicans trying to erode, if not overcome, the Democratic majorities in the General Assembly. How important is it to have, as Republicans, to have that kind of clear messaging emanate from the governor?
As we very clear, the message should be that we are for cutting spending. And that's one of the things that I want to see out of the governor, specific discussion of reducing spending. That's one of the problems that we've had, is the Democrats were obviously to ram through that tax increase with the support of some Republicans a couple months ago. And we should be clearly supporting lower property taxes. The people of the state want tax reduction. They're dealing with the Cook County soda tax. They paid their property taxes recently. They saw the withholding adjustment to higher taxes And that's a major problem. So we should clearly be for lower taxes, less spending, real reform in the state. And it's up to the governor to give that message clearly. Again, I don't think this is a staff issue. I think the governor needs to be just very, very clear about where he stands on issues and exactly what his position is. I think that would be very helpful to everyone.
Now, tomorrow, the governor is supposed to be in Pilsen to sign what's known as the Trust Act, and that's legislation that would prohibit local law enforcement from detaining someone for federal authorities based solely on their status as being documented or undocumented, that they could be held if there was a valid criminal warrant, but that they could not be detained purely based on their legal status. And that seems to be causing some consternation among some of the conservatives in the Republican Party.
Well, I oppose it. In fact, the governor, instead of being there for a bill signing tomorrow, should be in Springfield working against the Chicago bailout, in my view. But I do not think this legislation is necessary. John Cabello, a state representative, has been very clear, you know, on this point. We don't need to limit the ability of our police officers to enforce the law. So I hope the governor decides to go to Springfield tomorrow, fight against the Chicago bailout that he's been talking about for a long time, instead of signing this bill that's unnecessary.
That is Republican State Representative David McSweeney from Barrington Hills. Representative, as always, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Rick, and go Hawks, October.
Yeah, trust me, I've been wearing my Hawks hat. That's I'm ready for them. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with Democratic State Representative Teresa Ma from Chicago and Rebecca Shee, Executive Director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition. We'll be talking about that legislation, the Trust Act, that Governor Rauner is supposed to sign tomorrow.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning and welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. Joining me here in the studio is Democratic State Representative Teresa Ma from Chicago and Rebecca Shee, the Executive Director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition. Thank you both for joining me here in the studio today.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, I thought it was appropriate because I wanted to talk about the governor tomorrow is supposed to be in Pilsen to sign what's known as the Trust Act. And there's a lot of talk out there about people calling it a sanctuary bill. I mean, there's a lot of rhetoric going on. And I thought, you know, maybe you two both could provide an opportunity. Tell us what the bill does. And it did evolve.
Right. Yeah. So thanks, Rick, for having us. So you're absolutely right. So the bill started with 40 pages, and it was negotiated down to two. And it has the broad support of law enforcement, business, faith, and immigrant advocates. So I'll go over a little bit of what the bill actually does. And I think that it would be useful to have a debate around what this bill really is, rather than, you know, these alternative facts that people have been some people have been throwing out this week. So, you know, in the bill, and that's SB 31 with House Amendment number 3, what the Illinois Trust Act does is, number one, state and local police would not stop, arrest, or hold a person based solely on their immigration status alone. Two, law enforcement will honor ICE detainers that are sanctioned by a judge. And number three, law enforcement is allowed to communicate with federal agents, and this is fully compliant with federal statutory requirements. So these are the three main things that the Trust Act does. What it does not do is, number one, it does not create safe zones like hospitals or schools. It does not create sanctuary state or municipalities. And it does not prohibit law enforcement from communications with federal agents. And a lot of these points that are in the bill was negotiated by the Illinois Chiefs of Police, Illinois Sheriff's Association, and immigrant advocates that ended up with this language in the two pages that we see with the House Amendment number 3. So I think it's really important that these facts are out there to show that this is, you know, a good bill that will advance Illinois' the economy and also just build trust between the immigrant community and local law enforcement, which, you know, as, you know, Chief Ed Wojcinski of the Illinois Chiefs Association said on Friday and put out a really good statement, that that is the purpose and the spirit and the goal of this bill.
Teresa, I mean, that one, we're getting some text now, is could you mention who in law enforcement supports the bill? So we know the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police are on it. I believe most of the law enforcement groups are in support of. They're not even being neutral on it, they're in support of this.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, we've got folks like Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart, Lake County Sheriff Mark Curran, Illinois Association of Police Chiefs, which you've mentioned, Melrose Park Chief of Police Sam Pitassi, Stone Park Police Chief Chris Pavini, Franklin Park Chief Michael Wiltz. You know, these are law enforcement officials that are on the ground. They see what happens to immigrants every day. And, you know, I'll give you an example of why we needed this bill language, right? I have constituents who are driving around the, you know, on the interstates, and they may get into a fender bender. And ISP will come. And, you know, sometimes what will happen is that, you know, there's profiling that goes on. And, you know, we don't want that. And currently, ISP doesn't do that. But, you know, we need to codify it. We need to make sure that this is the law of the land in Illinois, that, you know, somebody who's just going about their business, you know, going to work or going to school, you know, earning money for their families, that they're not put at risk of being torn away from their families and put into deportation proceedings simply for, you know, doing an everyday thing, driving around. We have had examples, you know, I've heard testimonies from people in my district who've told me about being an offender bender and having ISP, you know, look up their immigration status and, you know, taking action that they weren't authorized to do, right? So what the Trust Act does is that, you know, it doesn't prohibit communication between ISP and ICE. You know, they can look up their, they can look up who they are and that sort of thing, but, you know, they're not allowed to take any action, detain them, or do anything if there is not a criminal warrant. And so I think that that's very important because, you know, we have law-abiding people who are just trying to live their lives. And, you know, we need to make sure that families are able to stay together, that they're not torn apart because of the immigration policies that we have that we're facing today.
Well, and I find it somewhat ironic that ostensibly, this bill is going to be signed tomorrow at the same time that on Friday we see that the president gives a pardon to Joe Arpaio, who was facing sentencing for criminal contempt of court from a federal judge appointed by George W. Bush, by the way, for ignoring prohibitions against profiling.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he was abusive and, you know, horrible, and it's just, I can't tell you how outraged I am about this pardon, because, you know, he's essentially saying that it's okay to go about and do those horrible things and to profile and treat people in such an inhumane way.
And, I mean, let's face it, part of the problem is that our immigration laws are a mess, mm-hmm. and the inability of the federal government and the Congress to get its act together to conduct a comprehensive immigration reform bill. And the fact is, this issue has now become a being used as a political football.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's absolutely right, Rick. And, you know, that we haven't had an actual fix to our system on the high skill, low skill, or for the undocumented for, you know, nearly 30 years. And so the reality is there are 11 million people who are living and working in the shadows. And, you know, the majority of them have been here for longer than 10 years. You know, they're dishwashers, they're crop pickers, you know, they're raising our children, you know, cleaning offices. And so when the federal government hasn't been able to, like you said, you know, do a comprehensive fix, we've seen that, you know, states like ours have advanced really smart policy, like the one, the Trust Act that the governor's going to sign tomorrow, but as well as, you know, the driver's license. It's been 5 years since we've had the driver's licenses for immigrants here in Illinois. And as you probably recall, when this was being debated, it was also, you know, a lot of just alternative facts and very polarized language. But if you look at the facts now, 5 years later, there's over 275,000 undocumented immigrants who are tested, trained, licensed, and insured. And that makes all of us safer on the road.
Yeah, and it became an issue even against some of the Republicans that had supported that over their votes for it in some of the political races of just how polarizing this topic is and how much it's just used for political purposes rather than practical, a practical acknowledgement of what's going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, I talked to our friend Sam Toya, the head of the Restaurant Association, about this legislation, and he talks about the fear factor. And as you said, that's why it was named the Trust Act, because if there's a fear factor going on, people aren't going to come to work. And you know, we know from Sam about how important the jobs are in the restaurant industry, how important those jobs are everywhere.
Right.
And if there's that kind of a fear factor that exists, I mean, there's an economic impact.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's one of the reasons we weighed in on this bill is because we, after the elections, we started hearing from our members, you know, manufacturers, retailers, restaurant owners saying that, look, even just in the span of 6 weeks, we have seen sales receipts gone down as much as 30%, right? I mean, the Little Village Chamber of Commerce and Little Village, the businesses there contribute the highest tax revenue to the city of Chicago, second to Michigan Avenue, have seen their sales receipts gone down around 35%. So it really became a business issue for our members. And the facts is that when immigrants are afraid to shop, businesses not only go down, but native-born lose their jobs as well, right? And so we decided that we wanted to be helpful on this bill so that, you know, we can continue to grow jobs here in Illinois, grow the economy. And that's the way to do that is to make sure immigrants are not afraid, right, to shop, to go to work, to pay taxes, to bring their children to school. So
we're speaking with Rebecca Shee, Executive Director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition, and Teresa Ma, Democratic State Representative from Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. A little John Mellencamp, who is up at the festival tonight up in Ravinia, and I'll be headed up there, and hopefully it won't rain. A message to Tom Skilling. We're talking about the Trust Act, which the governor is apparently supposed to sign tomorrow. Teresa Ma, Democratic State Representative from Chicago, and Rebecca Shee, Executive Director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition. I think it's interesting, too, the timing of this, since we're also seeing reports out of Washington that the president is talking about curbing DACA, ending DACA. And Rebecca, maybe you can explain DACA and what that means, and it's a fundamental change.
Sure. So the DACA stands for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and it was an executive order that President Obama issued. And what it does is it provides protection from deportations and work permits to nearly 800,000 undocumented young people who were brought here as children. And in Illinois, there are nearly 78,000 young immigrants who are have the DACA status. So since receiving DACA, many of these young people are going to school, working, paying taxes. Many of them have bought their first cars, first homes. And so the economic contribution has been enormous, and the economic loss will be enormous if this program is rescinded, revoked.
And we're seeing, you know, that's we're seeing reports that that's exactly what the president has in mind, which is kind of interesting because he has acknowledged in the past some kind of, you know, concerns for DACAs and Dreamers, as far as I've seen.
Sure. Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, he said many times since he was inaugurated that he said, you know, these are good, impressive young people, and that that he's going to, like, you know, look at this with a, you know, compassionate heart. I think that what we need to do actually is to call for, you know, a permanent solution for these young people, and that DACA is just a temporary status. It is by executive order. And I think now, right, given these reports that DACA could be rescinded, that we need to call for the DREAM Act or the RAC Act, something that puts DACA into legislation so that these, you know, nearly 800,000 immigrants, can continue to contribute to our economy and to our society here on a permanent basis.
But, Teresa, I mean, again, let's look at that political climate out in Washington. And, you know, we did have the Gang of Eight in the United States Senate at one time that had, you know, agreements. I remember going to the City Club and seeing now House Speaker Paul Ryan and Congressman Gutierrez talking about the need to enact a comprehensive Immigration Reform Act, and now that's just a non-starter.
Right. So I think that this shift in the president's position is, very indicative of how much he's paying attention to the far right, you know, the extremist wing of his party that somehow believes that, one's status, you know, the way somebody came over here, makes a difference in who they are. I mean, we're talking about young people who are just as American as anyone else, but for, this documentation, their citizenship status, how they came over, and, you know, the status of their parents. And, you know, I just, it breaks my heart to know that the president is just doesn't care that that people are ignoring the economic contributions of immigrants in general, but DACA recipients, Dreamers in particular, they're here in this country. They've grown up as Americans, and they make a huge contribution to our culture and our economy. I'm proud to actually, I think that I'm the first state representative to have hired a DACA recipient as, my district director. And, I wish that, more people would see, how critical their contributions are to American society. And immigrants in general, right? I mean, I come from a family of immigrants. My grandfather was an immigrant. My parents were immigrants. And, you know, my grandfather came at a time when Chinese immigrants were banned from coming to the United States. He came here as a laborer, but with false documentation saying that he was actually a student. So he wasn't supposed to be here, right? But our economy could not have developed without the labor of immigrants like my grandfather.
I want to, and education obviously is very important, and that leads me to my question to you. We have the legislative leaders are meeting in Springfield today to try to wrap up what I say is a near deal right now. And then the House of Representatives schedule be in at 11 o'clock tomorrow. And this is the school funding formula change. And I have to tell you, I'm getting the impression that this may not happen, that whatever deal is struck may not happen, because there's a great deal of rancor between the mayor and the governor, rancor with union opposition to the provisions for the private tax credit scholarship plan. Do you see this coming to, do you think this bill is going to pass?
I really can't tell you, Rick. I mean, it's a true dilemma for myself and many of my colleagues, because, I mean, I was one of the co-sponsors for SB1.
And the original bill that passed that Governor Rauner then rewrote.
Right. His rewrite was a disaster, and, you know, we showed that there was no support for that the last time we met in Springfield, when you know, the bill version of his mandatory veto got zero yes votes, right? I resent the, you know, continuous characterization of SB1 as a Chicago bailout, right? We're still hearing that. And you know, this provision in the compromise that includes a tax credit for wealthy people, you know, for private school scholarships, I mean, that's something that I personally can't stomach. And so, you know, I'm caught between a rock and a hard place, and I think that a lot of my colleagues feel the same, because, you know, we just can't see ourselves voting for $75 million of tax credits, which represents a loophole for, you know, rich people to contribute to private school scholarships. You know, and that takes away resources from public education. Right?
I'm a
strong supporter of public education.
And I see that concern on the Democratic side. And then on the Republican side, I see the concern that they figure, well, the argument on the Republican side was it's a Chicago bailout and everything for Chicago is still in it. And even the mayor says, and more. So, I mean, I think there's a on both sides, there are serious questions that I think makes this very doubtful.
Right. Like I said, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm really anxious about it. And, you know, I'm going to be there tomorrow for session at 11, and we'll see what happens.
So we'll stay tuned for more is really what this is all about. Well, Teresa Ma, Democratic State Representative from Chicago, Rebecca Shih, Executive Director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition, thank you so much for joining me here in the Old State Showcase Studio.
Thank you so much, Rick.
We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, Republican State Representative David McSweeney, Democratic State Representative Teresa Ma, and Rebecca Shih from the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening on this Sunday. And now it's time to turn things over to the great Dean Richards.
Is the fight over yet?
You know,
I don't mean political.
Did you stay up for
Mayweather?
It?
And no, I did not.
No, Sam was talking, and I actually heard that there was some problem with the pay-per-view that delayed the fight.
That delayed the fight because people,
there was so much money on the pay-per-view.
I think people paid, was it $20 to access on the internet? I think is what it was.
See, I'd be the wrong person
off
to ask.
Of PlayStation.
Off PlayStation?
Yeah, you could order it off PlayStation, and the PlayStation server crashed.
Okay.
If you're watching a fight on a PlayStation, you deserve to have it crash.
Yeah, thank you
very
much.
There's no way to watch a fight. I'm going to go to my PlayStation and watch two men beat each other to a pulp.
Yeah, boxing ain't my thing. Sorry. Yeah.
And I'm way too much of a cheapskate to. That's the other thing. Huge interest in it. We're going to be talking about that this morning. I'm also super excited that we are going to have the great John Mahoney joining us today. Marty Crane from Frasier.
Excellent.
Long time. In fact, one of the original ensemble members from Steppenwolf joins us today. He's about to launch a new play at the Steppenwolf. And we go back into the vaults today for our 2005 interview with Jerry Lewis, who passed away 1 week ago today. So we've got lots to get to, not to mention me complaining about the triathlon all morning long today. That's going to be at least half the show. You know that. This is.